Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Language is powerful, and the words that we use reflect so much about our society, including who has power. And language changes and grows all the time. There are plenty of words and phrases that were commonly used when I was a kid, but are now considered to be gross, hateful, and not appropriate for common usage, no matter what the context. And now, in the middle of what appears to be a historic human and civil rights watershed here in America, statues of controversial figures are being torn down. Should the same thing be happening with some of the words that we use? Should we acknowledge that there are words that have racist origins that are continuing to be used but are painful to many and can hold us back from growing as a healthy and inclusive society? Well, what do you think? We want to hear from you. This really is a community conversation. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and you can email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at TPRSource. We're joined for the remainder of the hour by Jamal Muwakkil. He is a PhD candidate in linguistics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And Jamal, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me, David.
Also with us is Professor Kerry Lattimore. He's a professor of history and African-American studies at Trinity University. It's always good to have you back, Professor Lattimore.
It's good to be back, David. Hope you're well.
Yes, sir. And Michelle DeGraff is a professor of linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And Professor DeGraff, it's good to have you.
It's great to be here. So thank you for inviting me.
So I want to start off first asking Jamal Muwakkil if... this moment in time, here we are. It seems like we're at a time when things can change. And do you see that there are ways of addressing lingering issues in our language, kind of like these statues that have been hanging around for a long time? They're finally coming down. Is it time for us to address some of these words and phrases that really they've hit their expiration date?
I think so, David, and I think it's what we need to really be focused on at the moment is about the future. So we're at an interesting moment at this time, and I'm very optimistic about being here. But my concern is that we won't be able to sustain the momentum for very long if people don't take the job of changing and learning a bit more deeply seriously. And I think that language is a part of that process. Language is a lens through which we understand our reality. And so if we're not able and willing to address the racist connotations, associations, and power dynamics that are implicit within our language and our linguistic use, then I don't know if we're going to be able to kind of grow past that next point. Lastly, I'd like to make the point about who we're centering in this conversation. Sometimes it's very easy to passively center an adult user and have this conversation about censoring. What I'd like to encourage us to frame this conversation is about the world that we're building for our children. Most times when there's a racist association to a term that becomes aware in the social consciousness, everyone just says, well, when I was a kid, it was normal. It was a common parlance when I was a child. And that's exactly right, because we're all subject to the culture in which we're born and where we live. And so if we're not willing to address that issue about how the racist ideas and racist associations are embedded in the language such that we can shift that to the betterment of our children, then we can't sustainably maintain this movement going forward.
Michelle DeGraff at MIT, how painful, how harmful is it for people to continue to use words with this heritage?
Well, I think Jamal said it so clearly, and what I'll do is to amplify a couple of the points that Jamal made, and in a way, I can do that very quickly by saying that we cannot say that Black Lives Matter if we don't take into account the way that language matters, the way our languages, we Black folks throughout the world, or that matters. And the point that's key is that most of us are not even aware of how language frames the perception of different ethnic groups and the way in which through language we learn very early on to value or devalue the humanity and the well-being of our fellow human beings. So as a Haitian, so I grew up in Haiti, I can use an example that I have to face almost on a daily basis in the cafeteria, at MIT, even just walking through MIT. The use of the word voodoo, for example, and for example, that in one campaign, there was this notion of voodoo economics. There are books written called Voodoo Science. And you find even the use of the word voodoo in children's literature. So, and here I want to echo a point that Jamal made. So if you think of, say, the author Dave Pilkey, famous for Captain Underpants, he wrote a book that was read to my son when he was in pre-kindergarten. And the book is called Voodoo Vultures from Venice. And in that story presents voodoo vultures as if they come from Venice and they come down to Earth to colonize the world and steal the children's cookies and ice cream. So this was read to my son. But in reality, what's voodoo? Voodoo is a religion practiced by 60 million black people as a authentic religion. And if you think of the history of voodoo, it is our ancestors that were enslaved, that were zombified by Europeans, that were made to work on sugar plantations. And our ancestors were dehumanized by Europeans in the quest for wealth and power. But you have children learning through these Pilsky storybooks that, in fact, voodoo vultures are the bad guys. And this is not just Dave Pilkey. If you look at the entire, Disney industry. So my colleague, Rosina Lippi-Green, a linguist, she wrote a wonderful book about the ideology that infiltrates the use of English. And she talks about how Disney cartoons use African-American English accent so Disney associates this accent with the bad guys. So basically, those cartoons, these children from the cradle onward are to be racist. So now imagine a child who grows up on a steady diet of Disney cartoons, and that child becomes a police officer or a CEO. Now imagine how that child, now a grown-up with a gun or in an interview, or that person will register the accent of a black person. Automatically, that person is viewed as a bad guy, and this is happening at the subconscious level. But it's clear that our attitudes as grown up towards different ethnic groups are often encoded and transmitted through language. That's why this debate is so important. So I'm glad that you have us here, and I look forward to the questions that might come up around these issues.
Professor Kerry Lattimore at Trinity University, as you're a professor of history and African American studies, do you see words and phrases that come up in common parlance and people don't actually realize that word or that phrase has all of this baggage connected to Jim Crow, slavery, oppression, and that people just don't know? And at least they deserve to know?
I think so. Absolutely. I mean, there are so many words that have that kind of a legacy, and sometimes even the way that you say those words. And so, when you think about the term aunt and uncle, it sounds benign.
All right. We apparently don't have really a very good line with Professor Lattimore, so we're going to try and get that cleared up in just a moment. And I'm going to go to the same question because I think it's important to Jamal Muwakkil. And so do you think many people don't know that this legacy exists for some of these words and phrases that they use? And at very least, what we can do with a conversation like today, that they will know?
Absolutely. I do think that the overwhelming majority of these issues come out of a place of ignorance. People don't know, and I would ask even a more intense question, how could they know? With the state of our public education system, it's hard enough to get any racial consciousness at all if you just take your hands off the wheel. You need to be really intentional to learn anything about the racialized history of the United States on the front end. So, of course, the racialized history of some of our idioms and adages, sometimes our place names even, are going to be wholly obscured and opaque to most folks. But I think that points to the next question. What do people do then when they come to find out? What's the response to a person saying, hey, did you know that that term, that idiom actually has a racist history, and it kind of makes a lot of people uncomfortable and maybe reaffirming some negative associations to different types of individuals? The question becomes, what do you do with that information? Is that a transformative moment? Is that an opportunity to learn more deeply, to read up on the history and get a better sense of how that word was formed, the cultural moment in which it was used most prominently, and the harm that's being done in the moment at which point you use it? Or is this a point of defensiveness where we double down and say, no, that's not racist because I didn't mean it to be racist, which is doubling down on an individualist frame, and which reaffirms the idea that only something that is racist is only something that is intentionally meant to be harmful, and only something that is only ever done by bad people. And if I'm a good person, I can never reaffirm or bolster racism. And that, of course, is an unfalsifiable claim. So I think that these opportunities and these conversations are great points of reflection to try to figure out, well, who are we and how invested are we in this project of equality and support?
All right. So I understand we have Professor Lattimore back with a better line. Do you see people not wanting to be better with this area?
Unfortunately, I see some people. I see a lot of people who don't know, but then I see some people, for example, the issues with, you know, when we talk about Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben and those kinds of things. I mean, certainly there's a racial past to that. And I think most Americans, I hope most Americans, understand that. And I think most people say that should be gone. But I have seen some people say, well, it's a legacy and I understand it. And that's a problem when we don't want to engage and when we just kind of say it is because it is. And so I see some people who feel a need to kind of hold on to that racialized past. But at the same time, I see in some ways language, and I'm not a linguist, but language changes, it shifts, it moves. And so I think for me, most Americans, the Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben idiom is kind of passe, I would hope. I think for some, however, it's not. And so that signifies something different. So I think we have to look at people differently. Those who may not know the history, those who know the history and don't care, versus those who may know a little bit, but perhaps need and want to learn a little bit more.
And then there are people who know the history and they deliberately use words and phrases, maybe in tweets and such, in order to bring that back, and they use it as a coded language.
Yes, I mean, languages also can be used in a power dynamic. And so one of the ways that, you know, when you think of the Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben versus Mr. and Mrs., that's a power dynamic. And so in a way of doing that, sometimes these people replicate the same inequities that were there that created the language in the first place, the meaning for that language. And so when you use it intentionally, and I think, again, we have to look at the word intentionally, that is a little more hideous to me than a person who may or may not know.
So here we are now telling folks that there are other words that are more appropriate, that don't have that legacy, the primary bedroom rather than the master bedroom. What about master itself? We have a master's degree, but is that something different? And how do we parse that out? And how do we hold people accountable, but, you know, still keep things in check? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Got some callers on the board. I'll get you on the air right after we come back from this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. An integral part of any culture is its language. Language not only develops in conjunction with society's historical, economic, and political evolution, but it also reflects the society's attitudes and thinking. And languages also express ideas and concepts, and they shape thoughts. By having a language that is rooted in racism, oppression, and gender bias, in many ways, it holds a us back from reaching our goal of a progressive and inclusive society. So how do we get there? The number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to the phones with Michelle. And Michelle, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, yes, thank you for having me. I'm Black, and I appreciate the conversation, but I'm just curious, you know, with changing the changing certain words that we're so used to saying, I know myself, I'm not that overly sensitive about it, and I'm not sure how that's going to change someone who has, you know, the root cause of their anger is hatred against races. So certain words like that, how is that going to change the narrative? That's my concern and my question. Thank you.
Well, Michelle, thanks for calling in. Jamal Muwakkil is a PhD candidate in linguistics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Jamal, what do you tell Michelle?
Well, I would say it's a great point to bring out and say that these issues aren't issues in isolation. So language is just one part of the issue that needs to be addressed. And so are so is the state of our structures and systems. But sometimes, and we can speak about the example of a person who maybe uses racially coded language, racist language, intentionally, specifically, I would argue, as a shibboleth to try to decide who's who, to try to speak to a specific audience and to oppress a different one. At the very least, this conversation and being aware, encouraging folks to be aware of the racist connotations of their language, allows a bit more clarity on who's who in the space. So we can actually have a conversation and help to build and develop with folks who are well-intentioned, who did grow up in a certain time or a different context, and we're wholly unaware and morally innocent in this regard. But the impact is still real and valid, and we can deal with that and have a conversation about unity in that frame, as opposed to those who might double down on the racist implications, actually truly mean to assert the power dynamics that are implicit therein. For those people, we can have a different kind of conversation with them and or around them. So I do think it's useful that we should have this conversation, but being very clear that this is not the end-all, be-all, there's a lot of work to do all around.
Carrie Lattimore, the band The Dixie Chicks, dropped the word Dixie, saying it is offensive because of its it refers to the Confederacy. Is the word Dixie automatically... A word that refers to the Confederacy and should be dropped?
I think in the context of today, I think it does have that connotation. And, you know, when you think of seeing Dixie, the song Dixie, we say the Dixie flag. And so the meaning to me certainly connotates the Confederacy. And for me, if the Dixie Chicks want to change their name to the Chicks, it's their right to do so. I think in this context, keeping the term also has a connotation as well. And so people really have to take a look at, when they're using language, understanding the changing times. Do they want to maintain that name in the context of what's happening today? And so I think that's a choice that people are going to have to make as well. Maybe 20 years ago, it may not have had that connotation, but I think today that it does. And I think historically, it certainly has a reason for us to assume that it does.
Let's go to another caller. Raven is on the phone. Raven, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because, you know, a lot of the words that are wanting to be changed have been wanting to be changed by African-Americans. I'm African-American for a very long time. However, you know, there's a large portion of white society, and like pretty much any non-Black society, that uses those words pretty okay. Like, they think they're totally fine, even if they know what those words mean, because our culture has basically made racism and white supremacy out to be something that is not integral to the politics and the education of our nation.
Oh, we lost Raven's call. Michelle DeGraff, professor of linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. As you're from Haiti, you're able to really be able to see with probably pretty clear eyes about that there is this ethnocentric white perspective rooting of our language, right? And does that kind of get to what Raven was talking about?
Yes, I think so, because I want to bring back something that James Baldwin said, that not everything can be changed, but until you face something and understand it, then you cannot change it. And I think that language gives us this, I think, this beautiful object, a tool that can use to understand our history. So I used the example of voodoo. So in my particular case, so once I was in the cafeteria at MIT, and I heard a colleague actually in physics using the word voodoo to refer to a tool that wasn't working and equations that he couldn't understand. So actually I went to him and I politely told him, well, you know, using the word voodoo in a negative way, I'm from Haiti, and in Haiti, voodoo is a religion that's practiced by millions of people and throughout the world. It's practiced in Brazil, in Africa, by more than 60 million people. He didn't know that. You see, and he said, oh, I apologize. I only use it to mean incomprehensible. I said, well, and he said, because I don't understand any religion. I said, well, would you use something like Christianity or Judaism to refer to something that you don't understand? And then he stepped back, and he was able to understand that, in fact, his use of the word voodoo was indeed stepped in racism, and hopefully now it isn't used anymore. So I think that we can use these words as opportunities to understand the way power hierarchies are built and how they are transmitted through miseducation, because as Jamal said, we are thoroughly miseducated. And it's not, and we can enlarge the debate, it's not just words per se, but it's the way sometimes we perceive entire language varieties. So if you think of, say, the Black Lives Matter movement, it was launched after the acquittal of Zimmerman. And Zimmerman, in court, the star witness, Rachel Gentile, clearly reported what she heard through the phone of Trayvon Martin, but her testimony, which lasted for hours, was dismissed. And there are two linguists, John Rickford and Cherise King, who has this beautiful paper in the Journal of Language, where they document the fact that the jurors ignored Rachel Gentile's testimony. Why? Because she spoke with a Black English accent, or what we call African American vernacular accent. So her accent was ruled guilty before Zimmerman was ruled innocent. This is a quote from the paper. So it shows us how, again, language is so pervasive in transmitting inequalities and injustice. So if we don't face that, how are we going to change that? So I think those words that we're discussing now give us this opportunity to understand the history of racism through language. And I think that's very important, I think, to as a route towards equity, towards a better future.
Accent is a whole other issue, and that's going to be something we're going to have to tackle on another day. San Antonio is a city of multiple accents and something to be explored. But I want to go back to Jamal Muwakkil, and if you could talk about some of the words that we have, particularly when using color symbolism, how that is something to be addressed.
Absolutely. Color symbolism goes way back in the U.S. consciousness. White being associated with pure, good, innocent. Black being associated with evil, with bad, aggressive. This kind of bleeds into sometimes unmarked language that has racist connotations. I'm thinking of the racial associations of words like thug or welfare queen and things like this, and this is what we're talking about, the idea of associations with words. So sometimes there are overt, explicit, like connections between a word, a phrase, and a racist history. We can think about the names, like some place names, like N-word Head Ranch, perhaps. Or
that's the ranch from Rick Perry.
Yes. That's pretty overt. But then there's other stuff that maybe is a bit more subtle and covert, but still carries the history.
Well, there's a creek called Lynch Creek that's between here and Austin. That always makes me wince when I see that.
Yeah, I'm here in Santa Barbara, California. There's a street called Indio Muerte, Dead Indian. It's not even trying to be covert at all. It's all very overt. And it's really hard to kind of understand how anyone can really argue that these ideas, these place names put in places of prominence, are not reaffirming certain associations about whose lives matter, what's valued, and what's important. We can regard them, of course, as historical artifacts, but only if we do actually regard them as historical artifacts and not proverbial sticks in people's eyes, which is what I might argue that they're functioning to do. So we really got to tackle these associations and really wrestle with the reality of what world are we building for those who understand and are socialized into the same cultural frames in society. And I want to thank Professor DeGraff for highlighting the awesome paper from John Ripwood and Cherise King on racial gentile, because it speaks about how those associations have material consequences, right? So if the association with a language, with a person, with a color, is just kind of understood on an interpersonal basis, but then you're on a jury. Now you're making decisions based on the association that you have with that person and those characteristics. And that could lead to a guilty or a non-guilty, to giving person the benefit of the doubt and or denying them the benefit of the doubt.
Because it goes to prejudice. It resorts to prejudice.
Absolutely. That's the material consequence.
And that's the last thing we want to have. That's really the thing we want to try to really eradicate and figure out a way to fix. All right, we're going to take another break. We've got some other callers. We'll get them on the air when we come back. If you want to join our lineup, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What do you think about trying to eradicate some of the words that we have in English language that are just outright racist? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
A filmmaker sought out to make a documentary about the progressive wave in Texas. The film kept taking unexpected turns.
The film really shows that struggle of, like, you kind of set out, you're going to look at this kind of bigger story, but then reality happens and it just kept pulling me back down to the border.
Kevin Ford talks about the pushback next time on Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In computer programming, there is the phrase you use, master and slave, so that you write one piece of code, it's going to impact other pieces of code. And people are thinking that's kind of language that really needs to be rethought. We can come up with better words for that that don't have this connotation, this history of hate and oppression. Other words that we have that people want to think about are like uppity, sold down the river, black sheep, urban thug. Where do these words come from? What are we actually saying when we use these? And it's not just racism, but it's also gender bias. And sometimes there's sexual violence embedded in our language. How do we raise our awareness and figure out a way to deal with this so that we can move forward? Let's go to our callers. And this is Samir. And Samir, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for having me. You guys just literally spoke to what I was going to comment on, is some of the words and phrases we use that some are more overtly racist, like uppity or shuck and jive, those types of things. But you just said a couple that were a little less subtle. Like, I just recently learned grandfather clause also has racist roots in disfranchising the black vote. No can do was an anti-Chinese phrase. Long time no see was Native American, against Native Americans. And these are everyday phrases, like peanut gallery. I've used the peanut gallery phrase a lot until I just recently learned how that's rooted in racism. So I guess my question is, some of these more subtle phrases in everyday vernacular that we have no idea that are white supremacy and racism, how do we better educate ourselves or maybe get more aware of some of these phrases that we use in everyday life that aren't overtly racist but do have those connotations?
All right, Samir, thank you for that. Carrie Lattermore, professor of history and African American studies at Trinity University. Peanut gallery is a phrase that goes back to the old days of like vaudeville and what have you, and they would have the cheap seats, and people would have leave peanuts on the floor, and it was just the cheap seats, and people, that's where many ethnic minorities would watch these programs. And now the question is using the word peanut gallery, which was also on a Howdy Doody program, and people hear it all the time, that's racist. You can't use the word peanut gallery. So should we eradicate that word from our language?
you know, I am somewhat, and possibly people disagree with me on this one, but I'm somewhat reluctant to be a personal, I would say we should just get rid of that under certain circumstances. I think it's better if we explain the history of it, and then, you know, maybe people will have a little better understanding of whether or not they want to use that term or not. It's not just a racial term, it's a class term. And so is that kind of the language that we want to use? And I think that that's, for me, I think that I was listening to Jamal, and I agree with him. I think it's a question of, is this what we want to be? Is this, do we not want to get better? Do we not want to create a better society? And one of the ways of doing that is looking at our language and trying to find ways that we can make it better. But at the same time, I'd be a little reluctant understanding class dynamics and dynamics of differences in regions to just automatically say this can't be said, that can't be said. I don't know if that gets us to where we want to go. I think what gets us to where we want to go is having more education around the subject and understanding this. When I was young, I didn't know what the peanut gallery meant. I didn't know all of these kinds of things, but I came to understand it through education, and then I made choices of what I would want to say or use or not say.
Right.
I think that's the way we should want to go.
Jamal Muwakkil, PhD candidate in linguistics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. There's also bad information about there about words. I saw a Facebook post someone put, and it was some saying that the word picnic has a KKK history to it, that they were going to pick someone to lynch, and that's where the word picnic came from. And I looked it up, and it's not true. It's actually a word with a German origin, and it's but sometimes this, we can kind of get carried away with this.
Yeah. So there's a few things I might say about this point. So one of them being there's a fair amount of so in one sense there's changing word meanings and associations over the course of time. This is a natural part of language over the course of time. The associations get built upon, extended, narrowed. And this is natural. The other thing is that we don't. So picnic in particular has an interesting history, but I'll focus on the idea of what do we do with, how do we find information? So one idea is education is the key here. I agree with Professor Lattimore. We don't necessarily want to be in the business of telling people what they can and can't say. That only gets us so far, and I think, and as we see a lot of times recently, it kind of fosters a bit of resentment, and that's not what we're actually after. What we're after is folks getting a deeper understanding of word origins, of history, of language, of the world they live in, and the history that we share. And that might inform different decisions that a person might individually choose to make if they want to reify an association or if they want to depart from it. So in order to make that decision, people have to kind of have the information. So we need to have good sources of information, good reliable sources of information where people can go to access information and make the best decision for themselves about how they'll conduct themselves, how they'll raise their families, and how they'll participate in society. So really important to shore up that you're making sure you're getting the best information possible, but always encourage on learning more deeply.
Let's go back to the phone lines, and Melissa has called in. Melissa, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, quickly. I'm so interested by the gradual but distinct shift, especially in scholarly literature, from slave to enslaved person. And I wondered if the panelists might offer some insight into when that began and why. And my second question is about capitalization. It's my impression that it is now appropriate and correct to capitalize the word Black when we are using it as an adjective to describe a person, like Black American. Am I correct? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Melissa, thanks for those great questions. Jamal Muwakkil, capitalization of Black. Seems like we should have been doing this all along because it's because the word is so important.
Agreed. Yeah. And I take it to doing so in my work, always capitalizing the word Black. But I do so equitably. I capitalize all racial categories out of respect to those different racial categories.
Enslaved the person.
The first part of that question about person first language, I think it's really important and broadly applicable. So The idea here is, instead of saying a person is the characteristic that we associate with them, like disabled person, deaf person, blind person, we might say person with disability, people who were enslaved. This way that we put forward the idea of their personhood as a primary characteristic, and then the other aspect, that adjective, as a other characteristic that builds on their personhood. So person first language has been taken up a lot of times by folks who are really interested in advocating for folks against oppressive systems. People of color is an example of this. So I think it's important that we do so, and it does gesture a sense of goodwill towards wanting to kind of tear down and push back against some of the more oppressive structures that are reified by language over time.
And Michelle DeGraff, you bring up the awareness about voodoo and how that word has been abused. And we have songs that use the word voodoo and black magic woman, Santana, black magic, Frank Sinatra. Should these songs and other cultural references, should they be left behind?
Well, so like Jamal and like Professor Latimore, I would hesitate to police language. As a linguist, I think that language can be used as an opening to understand history, to understand our humanity. And I think the end goal is not to police language, to ban certain use of language. The end goal, I think, is to create more generative structures for justice. And I think language can help us do that, because what happens is that in all these terms that have these racial histories, they are often used as metaphors for power. And if we don't understand how they are being used, then you just pass them on, and we allow children to grow up with those natural categories of humanity. For example, the notion of slaves versus enslaved person. I think I agree with Jamal that, and there's another linguistic point to be made, which is that slave is a noun. So when you refer to a group of people as slaves, it's like that's what they are. It's some inherent property that make them slaves. But if you say enslaved Africans, so first they're Africans, and then they've been enslaved. So there's a process led by other people that have enslaved them. So when you use that term, then you start to, you can unpack the history of slavery. It's, and the same with voodoo. So if you understand how did the term voodoo get to be used so negatively, then what you have to do, if you're a teacher, because at MIT I teach a course called Black Matters, I teach about Creole languages, and what we do, we use that opportunity to understand the history of voodoo and how did it come to be so stigmatized. And it's because of some spectacular silencing in history. So what we know, and these are facts, so the Haitians, we fought for independence back in the 18th century. We managed to win over this war against the French, against the British, against the Spaniards, and we declared Haiti independent. We abolished slavery back in 1804, at a time when both the U.S. and France were still slaveholding nations. Now, do you imagine that most kids, they learn about the French Revolution, they learn about the U.S. Revolution, but they did not learn about the Haitian one, when in fact, the Haitian one is the one that really showed that all lives matter, that showed that liberty, equality, fraternity is for all, that happiness can be pursued by all. You see, so here is one term that once you unpack its rich history, you can teach so much about the history of the world and the history of our humanity, our shared humanity. And then you put Haiti at the center of this movement for equality. So
right.
I think it's quite powerful to do that.
Michelle DeGraff is a professor of linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Also with us this afternoon, Carrie Lattimore, professor of history, African-American studies at Trinity University, and Jamal Muwakkil, PhD candidate in linguistics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.